All right, well, thanks. That's right, there we have it. Drop the mic, yeah. Walk away. No, we have a lot of sharp folks here interested in this, of course. So let's just open the floor for conversation. Please remind us of your name again when you ask your questions, and we'll leave the remaining time for discussion. We've got about 25 minutes.
Yeah, Tomeo.
How different is Simone Weil from other saints? For instance, St. Ignatius, or even Jesus. I know it's not the same. But how different is their story? How this, these represented, are they in other similar groups? I mean, I was comparing a little bit what you were saying about Simone Weil and their construction, the image that they portray with other Christian figures. And what I see is that there is no pure figures and there is no pure history. What you have is a biography of Ignatius, for instance. I'm talking about Ignatius because we are here. because this is a Jesuit university. And who is right with Ignatius? I mean, his autobiography probably is the closest, but then you have all the other biographies also emphasizing parts that are very according to the moment. And the same with Jesus. The Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, if you start reading the Gospels, you can you can draw very different things, and above all, against the Jews,
mm-hmm.
actually. When you read that, you say, is Jesus again the Jews? Or it's a group of people in the earth, in the first community that was really against that community? So I think that my point here is that 100% true that she was so disrepresented? What do we know about Simone Weil? What do you think about her?
Well, I was obviously very much engaged with that precise problem when I referred to the search for the historical Simone Weil. So I was acknowledging it as an integral part of the question of historiography and hagiography. So yes, it's a common problem. But there are two things that make this a little bit different. The first is that it's so recent. In other words, the search for his historical Jesus is 2,000, it forces us to go back 2,000 years. The search for the historical St. Ignatius forces us to go back 500 years. So we have different standards, we have different sets of expectations, we have different degrees of confidence about our surety in making any statement. The second point is that I would argue that the way in which she has been manipulated is much more extreme than what was done certainly to St. Ignatius. Whether or not it was more extreme than what was done with Jesus Christ is a different question. But certainly more extreme than what was done with St. Ignatius, whatever the distortions of the hagiography. I think the last point I would want to make is that we all are aware of the problem of the historical Jesus. No one here would deny that it's an issue. And to some extent, we all are aware of the different versions of St. Ignatius's life. But my argument would be that that Simone Weil has sort of floated under the radar screen, that the problems I've addressed in this particular instance, similar as they are to the classic dichotomy which you suggest, have been completely ignored. And so I'm trying to say there is a problem here. We have to recognize it, and we can't blithely continue to ignore it. It doesn't mean that she's worthless, she's evil. it does mean that the complexity of her role has to be addressed before we can fully understand it. And the complexity of the representation is also great. I mean, it's sort of like, to take another example, I know there are two questions, I'll turn to them shortly. The figure of Emily Dickinson, whom we all know as the great 19th century woman poet, the muse of Amherst. And increasingly, scholars are realizing that the way in which Emily Dickinson has been represented is the result of lots of different distortions. So I'm just saying, if we can do it for Jesus and we can do it for Emily Dickinson, we also have to do it for Simone Weil. Now, I think I'll let the visitor go before the resident father, so please.
Thank you for your talk, very instigating. Well, Tomil brought already the question of facts and interpretation. I think that we belong both, Tomil and I, we study a lot Simone Weil. We belong to associations, and we know that there are always conflict of interpretations between the stream that is more in the direction of recognizing her Catholicism and the others who underline their agnosticism and the other, and I think too that she died in the middle of the war.
Right.
It was a very complex moment, you know, so about the anti-Judaism, etc. But I would like to bring a doubt. I stayed after your talk about dates.
Mm.
Because you mentioned that she didn't have any spiritual or Christian approach because before the 40s. Understood well?
I'm making a distinction between general mystical, general spiritual, and specific Christian, and more specifically Catholic.
Okay.
That's the important. And one of the problems is that people have tried to make it sort of absolute, but we have to recognize is there's a process of transition which is going on in her life.
I agree fully that is a process, but I think that before the 40s, in 37,
mm-hmm.
she had a spiritual experience in the context of a Catholic expression in Portugal. In Povo do Varzim,
mm-hmm.
the procession of the women around the lake. And I think it's a very interesting one because she uses the words of Nietzsche,
mm-hmm.
Reversed to describe it. Christianity is the religion of slaves,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And slaves cannot not adhere to it, and I among them.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I think the same year perhaps.
38, you're talking about Solem.
No, Assisi.
Assisi is earlier. Is 35.
Stronger than I obliged me to kneel down in Santa Maria degli Angeli. It's si. Aesthetic, but also, St. Francis, she was very devoted to St. Francis. And 38, Solemn. Mm. Then she tells the Passion of Christ because she had the headaches and the Gregorian chant. So said the pain and the beauty, the Passion of Christ entered me once and forever. And it was in Solem that she met the famous English Catholic boy with an angel face that gave her the poem, Love, from George Herbert. And it was, when reading this poem, she said, I didn't know it was already a prayer, that she had the mystical experience. Christ himself came down and took possession of me. So it perhaps could be before the 40s. No.
But none, also. There is no evidence. We have several problems with these events. First of all, I do not question that in 1942 she wrote what you have just described. In 1942 she wrote what you just described.
Okay.
But she did not write it before 1942.
Okay.
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are several issues. She has a great problem with time and with chronology.
Don't we all?
And she has a bit. She writes in one time in a letter that I've dropped into a cave and I have lost all sense of time and place. She almost never dated her letters. She almost never placed her letters. She was out of time, out of place. She existed in a mystical plane that was beyond the confines of the temporal order. So she is not someone who has a historian's, chronographer's instinctive need to place things at a certain moment. So I'm not saying she was lying in 1942 when she has these recollections. I'm saying that to try to place them at a particular time, and she could place them in a place, and that was important, and the places are real. I'm not questioning any of the places. But when she, and she did have experiences that were memorable experiences, but the question is how and when does she understand those experiences in the way that you just described them? Mm-hmm. And she, we know that she described them that way in 1942. Mm. Then we look at contemporary evidence, Simon Petremont, her cahier, her notebooks, her journals. None of that appears at the time. Let's take two other very specific points. In the spiritual autobiography in 1942, she describes the meeting with the angelic Englishman and the... and the poem by George Herbert Love. And if you read how she describes it, one of the first important points is that she doesn't really place, she says she first was introduced to the poem in Solem in 1938, but she doesn't say how and when that poem assumed its mystical significance in her spiritual consciousness. She said that she read this poem. She said, I don't know for how long, I'm now paraphrasing, I don't know for how long, I read and reread and read and reread this poem to the point that it became a kind of mantra.
Of a prayer, yeah.
Of a prayer. A deep. So I can easily imagine that she read it in 1938. It didn't acquire the meaning that she gave it in 1942. And so... there was a genuine response to this poem, but it, we have to, if we want to look at it historically, we have to recognize the complexity of any mystical experience, that it does evolve over time. As I said, there are genuine mystical experiences, but we have to recognize that the time and place of them is much more complicated than a simple, straightforward date. So I think, and then the other, Simon Petremont, who was her very, very closest friend, their biographer and her biographer, says that she was completely unaware of any of this. I mean, so for what that's worth. I mean, maybe it was internal, maybe she shared it with no one, but she shared it with not her best friend. She shared it not in her own commonplace books, the cahier, where she was writing down her experiences. So there's no contemporary evidence. And then when there is that, what I think is the most important document, which in fact is the document which has to be looked at and is usually ignored, and in many of the, I noticed that you have one of the readers, in many of the readers, it's not included, is this letter that she wrote in October and November in 1940, directly in reaction to the three October 1940, Vichy anti-Jewish decree, the French version of the Nuremberg Laws. No, c'est avant Valard. C'est le truc, because there is oftentimes attention to the Valard letter that was written, I can't remember the exact date, more or less a year
later. Was this letter? Then?
This letter was written to the Ministry of Public Education. And it was never sent, as the Valard letter was never sent. Now, I've compared the Valard letter to the earlier letter very carefully. The earlier letter is the more important letter, because the Valard letter is basically a recapitulation of the major themes of the October-November 1940 letter. And it's in that letter that she claims that her patrimony is Greek, French, and Catholic, which I think you could not find in anything that she has written.
Absolutely true.
No, absolutely false. Her patrimony was not Catholic.
Greek.
No, Greek, French, but it was not Catholic. That's a false statement. And she knows it's a false statement, because when she writes the same letter a year later to Valard, she omits the reference to Catholic patrimony. So she sort of, and not that she ever sends either one, but when she's rethinking it, she recognizes, I can't claim a Catholic patrimony. That would be false. And, you know, then when she comes, the other aspect, she also says, in that same letter, with a variation in the Valard letter, that she claims that if I had, and I'm now paraphrasing, and I may have gotten the phrasing wrong, if I were to have basically religious, spiritual, mystical, Christian beliefs, they would be Catholic. Mm-hmm. Now, that can be understood in a number of different ways, but it does suggest that in October, November 1940, whatever was going on with her spiritual development, it was still inchoate and ill-formed, so that she couldn't say, "I have this." It was conditional, and it's put in this kind of contrary to fact conditional fashion. And I can't remember. I actually did an explication de texte of the grammar of the verbs that she used in this sentence, because they are very significant. And for someone who is aware of French and a master of French style, you have to pay attention to that. But it's clear that there's a process at work here, but the process had not been realized in October of 1940. It emerged under the in extremis, under the circumstances that she went through. Now, the attention to the Valla letter rather than the earlier letter is significant, because if you go into the earlier period, the October to November period is before she has any contact with Catholic circles in Marseille. It's an early stage of her turn. And when you recognize that as a chronologically significant point in her life, then you have to come up with a different chronology. If you just look at the Valla letter, which is written a year later, that's at a different stage in the process. I saw that. Father and Billy.
No, it's fine, because really it was pretty much that. But let me just add a point or two, if I may. Firstly, thank you, it's illuminating. With respect to some of what was said, I think of Cardinal Newman, mm-hmm. in the sense that the river is not necessarily clearest at its source.
Absolutely.
Of course, of development. And so her appropriation of her experience might be really the valid interpretation of her experience. So that's just a general point.
Yeah.
The other two things, reference to the Herbert poem.
Mm-hmm.
So you find no reference before 40 to its importance for her?
I do not find any reference before, but I may, hold on. Importance is one thing.
Yeah.
And at the moment I cannot be precise about whether or not I think it does appear before 40. Meaning and interpretation and significance is something else.
Sure.
Okay, and that's my point. That all the raw materials were out there. St. Francis of Assisi. Herbert poem. The saintly faced English student. Was he going to be a Benedictine, or was he? I can't remember.
A layperson.
I think it was a layman.
I'm not. I think you're right.
And then she says, by looking to him, I understood for the first time the virtue of the sacraments.
In 1942, she writes this in 1942. That's my point. Mm-hmm. That you have a process where you have the seeds planted. I'm not questioning that in any way. The question is, what grows from these seeds? And what is the soil? Does it get nurtured? Does it not get nurtured? What are the terms? And so to understand what this meant to her, you have to recognize that this was a process that developed over several years, and you cannot deny the traumatic circumstances in which it eventually emerged. Which I say, you could talk about the fruit of a poison tree, and you have to recognize this complex set of contradictions that I think have been completely ignored in approaching and understanding her. Sorry, Jonas?
Clarification, she's not officially a saint.
No, of course, I said, I said quasi-saint.
So the term hagiography also carries thing there.
Well, I mean, but she was, she will never be canonized. She will never be beatified for lots of reasons.
And she, is it true that she was asked to convert, but she never did.
I
was going to say, right? She wasn't even a Catholic.
Well, first of all, up until 1943, up until the time of her death, there is no question that she was invited to convert and never did, and wrote serious objections to conversion. Now, the question becomes what happened in the last hour or day of her life. And there is one source who herself was a Jewish convert to Catholicism, who was close to her and who was present with her in England at the time of her death in Kent. And she claims that she did, in fact, accept conversion.
Simone Dietz.
Simone Dietz.
There is a video with her.
Yeah, Simone Dietz. And she's the only person who makes this claim, and other people don't take it seriously. So I'm not... what is true is that the time... And she didn't write anything after that point. I mean, she didn't live after that point. So it's not like we can say for certain. We can say that up until 1943, she refused to convert to Catholicism. And the way in which she talked, and this is why I call her semi-sincere, because there's quite a bit of material that's come out in the last, that's been published and been discussed in the last few years, but has not gotten the attention that it deserves. And there's a discussion which her her niece writes about in her book about the Vey family. And it's also to be found in one of the later volumes of the Oeuvre Complete. And Nevin talks about it, Thomas Nevin talks about it in his study of her. And she's urging her brother to baptize her daughter, their firstborn. And the mother was Catholic. The father was non-observant, possibly a Hindu. That is, the daughter describes, if he had a religion, it would probably be closest to Hinduism. But he wasn't interested. And Simone pesters them, pesters the parents, pesters the brother, and says, you have to convert him. And then she comes up with all sorts of reasons. And one of the reasons is that... perhaps there will be some kind of government in the future that will enact anti-Jewish discrimination laws, and if she's converted to, if she has a baptismal certificate, she would escape them. So, I mean, she's not unaware of the social implications. She also said maybe you don't want to convert her because you would consider it an act of cowardice. Of course, the further irony is after she writes that, she then goes to work for the Free French government in France. She is presented with a memorandum as to policy regarding non-Catholic communities, non-Christian communities, after the war. And there is one which calls for a very, very severe regime of discrimination, basically creating a second-class citizenship. And she reads this memorandum, and she doesn't criticize it or attack it. She basically reduces the level of severity. So she anticipated a kind of Vichy light regime after the Second World War, and she was perfectly comfortable with that.
Mark, did you have a question still?
Yeah, but do we have time? You look like you're about to wrap up.
I'm going to say we have time for one more question.
I get the last bit. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, it's only 1 o'clock. Do we have until 1:15?
We can. We typically go till about 1:05.
Okay.
As you go to 1:07 or so?
Yeah, make 1:07.
So yeah. I'm Mark Oppenheimer again. It strikes me that, let's say what you're really saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not that you shied away from it, but I think you're actually saying more. When you point out at the beginning that only one or two pieces of the Vey scholarship have been by historians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying, what I take from what you're saying, I'll put it in my words, is that theologians, in particular Catholic theologians, have been perfectly content with a slipshod scholarship because she's incredibly useful to the Catholic project. She's useful to Catholic evangelism. I'm saying this. You can correct me if I'm wrong, right? She's not literarily...
I wouldn't say slipshod, but that's...
She's not literarily interesting to anyone else. I've never known a Jew to read her. I've never known a Protestant to read her.
You're wrong.
Okay, you can tell me I'm wrong. You can tell me I'm wrong. In my gazillion years of teaching and learning, or mostly learning and now teaching... the place you see her on syllabi about Catholic theology, Catholic mysticism in particular, right? And that's fine because that's what religious communities do, is they find useful paths to understand what they believe and often to introduce other people to what they believe. And for that project, converts in particular, or quasi-converts, are especially useful. Now, that said, if one's to take an historical approach to her, I would say it scarcely matters whether these are 1938 or 1942, whether certain crystallizations happen in 38 or 42, they happen after 1933. I mean, they happen after it's clear that there's a large force on the European continent that makes it exceedingly unpleasant to be a Jew. And, you know, it's not accidental that one sees as a historian or as a journalist, you know, that there are more Jewish converts to evangelical Protestantism in Alabama than there are in Israel. You gain a lot by converting in rural Alabama that you don't gain by converting in Israel or Brookline.
Is that true?
Oh, unquestionably. I mean, percentage-wise. Okay. Percentage-wise. No, absolute numbers, who knows? Right, you know, depends how you draw your boundaries. But you know, one of the impetuses for all sorts of psychological processes is that they make life easier, right? That they reduce mm-hmm. conflict and that they reduce inner turmoil. So it seems to me that the place you would want to begin a recent book on Gertrude Stein, who was living in France this time, mm-hmm. begins, as one begins, with assimilated, you know, not deeply Judaized Jews who find something in Christianity in, you know, post-Weimar Europe, mm-hmm. is with the fact that there's tremendous anti-Semitism in the air, even if at times it recedes and if at times Jews have tremendous options and access to power or whatever, that, you know, any reading of her theology or experience, let's put it this way, it can't proceed without significant attention to why one would want to have those experiences, why subliminally or unconsciously one would want to have philo-Christian experiences. So I think that some of the attention to, you know, was it 1930? I mean, that's historically very interesting and sounds like important work, but I'd actually say there's a larger complex here, right? There's a larger context than just when Pétain came to power.
No, I would agree with you. I mean, again, it's a process, and the way you've outlined it is perfectly correct. But the point is, and this is why I think it's historically necessary to do this, is that if you can pinpoint mm-hmm. a moment and an event, as you can with the 3 October 1940 decree, where all of this came home to roost, where all of it assumed a direct and specific and highly disruptive, to put it mildly, effect on her, then you make a case that is much stronger than if it's just in the air and it's part of what's
sure.
going on. So that's why I wouldn't say slipshod, because as you said, it's a different set of concerns.
Right.
But the difficulty is that while you can have different set of concerns, the expression of what your agenda is has to take into account the complexity of what you are interpreting. And I think it would be a much more profound and difficult process to appropriate Ve if you can do so with the necessary recognition of all of the contradictions, which are human contradictions, and of all of the complexity and, frankly, the profoundly discomforting elements of what's happening. Quite apart, I mean, so that's the essence, that's whatever Ve, whoever Ve is, quite apart from the history of the way in which she was used, which is one of the things that I was doing. I think there was another question. Oh, yes, Jews and Ve. At that talk, which I gave at Harvard, actually zeroed in on that point. There was a period in the late 40s, early 50s, when serious Jewish thinkers were very, very interested in Ve. This was reflected in the pages of commentary. It was reflected in the thinking of all people. I've repressed his name and his son's name.
Podhoretz?
No. The pre-Podhoretz Podhoretz.
Crystal.
Irving Kristol, in fact, was quite enthralled with Ve. And Leslie Fiedler was enthralled with Ve. And they, in fact, and Emil Fackenheim, who becomes a significant theologian of the... who engaged with the Shoah as a theme that had to be theologically reckoned with. And also a Jewish student of Husserl's, whose name I can't remember, who taught philosophy at the SUNY Buffalo. All of them were quite intrigued with the notion that maybe they conveyed a certain kind of spirituality that would be important in terms of reconstructing a post-Shoah Jewish theology. That somehow that she had something to give them. And this got articulated in a series of essays that Leslie Fiedler published, and in the introduction to his volume, the Waiting for God U.S. version. Now, this didn't last very long. I think Levinas raised some problems, and Martin Buber raised some problems, but there was this period, and part of the reason for their blindness was that they were only looking at the English, the U.S. versions, and didn't see the totality of what she had written, and may not have read the French very carefully if they had access to the original. But I think so there was this period, it didn't last very long, and you can see the point at which the editorial approach on part of commentary towards they changes in basically about 54, 55 onward, and then it becomes much more critical. But initially it was very sympathetic and very willing to consider her seriously, because they were not, because in part they were misled by what Perrin and Thibon had done. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the reason. So they were victims of that. But they were also so eager to find something that they grasped at this. So it was significant, and I don't think... And actually, I was in correspondence with Gertrude Himmelfarb, who is Irving Kristol's widow. And I didn't want to say, how in the world could your husband have fallen for this character? But I was sort of very neutral and very ginger. And she just said, you know, a lot of his stuff is now going to be available. It's being reprinted on some kind of CD-ROM. But she said he was very interested in issues of Jewish spirituality. And I think too uncritically interested in this particular case.
Interesting. Well, this has been terrific, and please feel free to stick around for a little bit with the speaker, but join me in thanking the professor.